Welcome to this series on metabolic health. Welcome to this latest installment from In the Know. This one's on metabolic health. You might have listened to the dozen or so I did on longevity or all the other tech and innovation stuff over the year. This one's really exciting. It's really topical. Ozempic's been all over the news. Buckle up, because we're going to get under the covers. This time we've got Dr. Will Balisiewicz, MD, gut biome expert, huge advocate for a widely varied diet, plant-centric, high in fiber, and the medical lead for a really interesting company you'll hear about that is really seeking to help people improve their GI and their gut health. Let's kick into it.
Great to have you. So, you know, the series we're doing is metabolic health, and I have been doing a bunch of talks with different researchers, clinicians, founders, investors across a variety of topics in longevity and more recently on metabolic health. It's of concern to the stuff that I work on. So my venture fund, LifeX, is an investor in technology-driven companies. So, you know, like software, internet kind of companies that relate to the life sciences. So we'll do things that support biopharma or health systems or just patients. Some of the stuff we do is serving patients or consumers in how they manage their health. But there's lots of overlap there. We don't invest in drug companies necessarily, but we are living in an exciting time for both biology and also for the intersection with technology, all this computational biology stuff, all the kinds of data that we're getting and the way we can synthesize and design new kinds of vaccines or drugs or proteins or all that kind of stuff. And I did like 20 conversations with longevity researchers that we published on this series, on the In the Know series. And lately I've been doing a package of another 10 on metabolic health, since apparently it's the most important thing in the world this last year or two. And it all flows through the gut, right? I mean, this GLP-1 revolution, I guess, has something to do with the gut.
Yeah, totally.
I don't know that. I don't think that the popular understanding has got it buttoned down, but clearly there's something happening with digestion and this neurotransmitter, and maybe it's going from the gut to the brain, or maybe it's not, or the pill has some other kind of effect or something like that. And this is right at the heart of your work. And so I've been really interested to talk with you. And so I've been looking forward to our conversation today. Maybe a place to start, though, if I can just call you Will, or no, Dr. B. Do you like to go by Dr. B?
Yeah, I mean, I love that. That's great.
We actually have a company called Dr. B in our portfolio. It's hidrb.com. It's like an AI doctor. But you can be my new favorite Dr. B. Maybe a good place to start is to just learn more about you and how you've developed your career and your practice. And then we'll get into more of the substantive technical stuff from there.
What matters is that my personal mission and like my orientation throughout my life has never really changed. It goes all the way back to when I was a teenager. I'm in my mid-40s now. When I was a teenager, I decided that I wanted to become a medical doctor. And to me, like the motivation there was that I get to spend my time basically working to improve people's lives and be compensated for that. And that to me is an incredible, powerful sort of thing to sort of put your time into. And Amal, it took me 16 years of medical training. So I went to Vanderbilt for 4 years, chemistry degree, Georgetown for medical school, 4 years at Northwestern in Chicago. I was the chief medical resident. That was internal medicine residency. And then 4 years at the University of North Carolina as a gastroenterology fellow, chief gastroenterology fellow. I was also on a grant from the NIH while I was there. So 16 years total of training. But the interesting thing during this is, and I'm sure you can appreciate this, that in medicine, like particularly when we're in our training, they ask us to give everything. Like we have to sacrifice everything. And that includes ourselves. Like we basically get consumed by this profession. And we're working 80 to, you know, sometimes many more than 80 hours per week. And in that moment, you don't have time to even wash your clothes. So you just want to feel good once in a while. And I think different people have different ways in which they sort of pursue that, where you just want to feel good once in a while. And for me, that was food. And the problem is that ultra processed foods or fast foods, they fit so perfectly into my life. They were inexpensive. I had no money. I mean, I had a tremendous amount of debt, but Oh no.
Dr. B, are you telling me that you had an eating problem?
The problem is that I sacrificed my own health in order to be able to do my job. And I woke up one day in my early 30s and I had tremendous health issues. And I was 50 pounds overweight. I was metabolically unhealthy. I had high blood pressure, high cholesterol, but I also had very low self-esteem, even though professionally everything was going really well for me. And the key is that, like in that moment, where I was the one who needed help. I didn't want my own medicine, even though I spent 16 years pursuing this. I wanted to actually get to the root of the issue. I wanted a dietary approach. And it was hard for me to figure it out because I hadn't actually been taught how to do this. And I ended up discovering the power of a high fiber diet, completely transformed my life. And in my work as a gastroenterologist, I then brought this into the clinic to help my patients who have irritable bowel syndrome and ulcerative colitis and acid reflux. And I watched person after person after person, they were having their own radical transformations. And this is like, we're talking about 15 to 10 years ago right now. But basically, as this played forward, I got to a position where I felt like it was inadequate for me to be a gastroenterologist in a community taking care of a few thousand people when I felt like everyone needs to hear this. And so it led me to start my social media, which led to podcasting, which led to my book deal, which led to 2 New York Times bestselling books. And it also led me into my work as the U.S. Medical Director of Zoe. We are a personalized nutrition company that's trying to empower people to achieve better health, not just by taking pills, but instead by addressing their diet and their lifestyle and actually working from the inside out.
High fiber diet. It was as easy as that. I mean, are we talking about some spoonfuls of psyllium that you got yourself on 10 or 15 years ago?
No, definitely not. The thing about nutrition, Amal, is that it's all about substitutions. So what are you replacing with what? And when your starting point is a fast food diet, you have a lot of opportunity for improvement. But to take that and replace it with a high fiber diet, which I'll give you an example. When I started doing this, the way that I approached it, I was a busy guy. I was in my medical training. I was cooking for one. I didn't have a family. I was single. And I needed something quick, easy, and expensive. So I started making smoothies. And not just like one cup, but like a massive blender full. And it made me feel full. It made me satiated. It also, though, made me feel energized. I didn't have that sort of post-meal hangover that typically occurred after I had dinner, you know, went to Hardee's or something like this.
You know, you're referring to a dark past. I'm worried about all the roast beef sandwiches that you're eating. But the transition to the smoothies, I mean, it's an interesting one because they're so topical. Smoothies are deceptive. I mean, you can get them all full of sugar and apple juice and seem like they're healthy, but it's just candy. What kind of smoothies were you making?
Well, I mean, the beauty of making your own is you control those factors, right? It's a little bit different than popping into a health and wellness store and paying 10 bucks for something, or Smoothie King, you know, and paying 10 or 12 bucks for something and they just make it full of sugar. It's a pretty simple formula. I mean, I don't believe that you need to worry about the consumption of fruit in any way. I don't believe that the natural sugar that exists within fruit is a problem. It's a little bit different if you're going to juice it. But when you take it and you blend it, it still retains the fiber content, among many other things. So what I would do is just basically fill this blender up with a ton of greens, which could be whatever you prefer, spinach, kale, some bananas, add the creaminess with the bananas, berries. And then I'm also a big believer in healthy fats. So that could be walnuts, chia seeds, flax seeds, hemp seeds, or all of them. Put that into a blender, add whatever liquid of your choice, buzz it. It takes like 2 seconds. It's extremely easy to do. And at least for me, I find it to be extremely delicious and also energizing. So I think the key is like, I mean, all things can be like twisted into healthy versus unhealthy. When it comes to smoothies, if it's just a berry smoothie, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about something that's basically a homogenized salad. You're taking a salad, putting it into a blender, and then what comes out still tastes great, but it also is empowering your body, fueling your body with the good stuff.
Let's see. A lot of the fiber, I guess, in this case is coming from the chia seeds and the flax seeds, right? Just in terms of the density of fiber. I mean, you could eat a lot of green leafy things and you really need to eat a lot to get a substantial quantity of fiber. Bananas don't have much. Even berries kind of don't have as much. I mean, it seems like it's all about those seeds, huh?
Well, I think from my perspective, there's value to each of these particular ingredients that you just mentioned. And, you know, we could dig into every single one of them in their own way. There's a story that exists of how they nourish your body with some combination of fiber, polyphenols, phytochemicals, other vitamins and minerals. So to me, it's not necessarily fiber. It's not grams of fiber. You know, when you brought up the possibility of using psyllium husk, that's not the way to approach this. The way to approach this is to eat more plants. All plants have value. And the science is showing us, Amal, you know, there was a study that started, it was published first, I believe, in 2018. It's called the American Gut Project. At the time, was the largest study to date to allow us to take a look at a person's gut microbiome we will discuss in more detail, is central to our metabolic health. In this study, that was the largest study at the time to allow us to take a look at their gut microbiome in connection to their diet and lifestyle. And when they ran their analysis, it was not the grams of fiber that was the essential factor. It also wasn't the dietary pattern. It didn't matter whether you called yourself vegan, paleo, keto, or anything. It didn't matter. What mattered was the variety of plants. Yeah. So first of all, like fiber, it's the, you know, you and I as kids, like being raised up in our culture, we're taught, oh, well, it's the grams of fiber and there's that orange drink that grandma has so that she can poop. There's this new view. There's this new science when it comes to what is fiber? How does it work? How does it impact our microbiome? And what the science is showing us is that fiber is like incredibly complex. And there's many different types of fiber. So when we use terms like soluble or insoluble fiber.
Help us understand that. I mean, so let's see, what do I know about fiber? Yeah, there's the grandma thing. And you sort of hear that it's sort of generically good. And then maybe people know that as you digest, this kind of fiber moving through your colon is sort of scraping up cholesterol or other things that you don't want and trying to move them through. And maybe that's a good thing. Soluble means you can mix it with water and insoluble means you can't.
Well, so yeah, from a sort of chemical property perspective, that's exactly right. I mean, we're just describing whether or not it dissolves in a drink versus doesn't dissolve in a drink. And the insoluble fiber, no matter what you do, it's not going to dissolve. It's there to stay. That's the grit. That's the roughage. What you just described is exactly the way that I understood fiber after I graduated medical school and even was in practice as a medical doctor. That's what I was taught.
Oh, well, I was going to say good for me because I didn't do medical training that I know so much, but I suppose I'm about to be corrected. It turns out that that's not an adequate understanding, is it?
Well, I think that this is where it's the evolution of science. And, you know, unfortunately, the sad reality is that studies suggest that when a paper is published, it actually takes about 17 years for it to work its way into widespread adoption within a clinical practice. 17 years. So in other words, we're operating on 2007 data right now, which is inadequate. So when it comes to these distinctions, the key is that soluble fiber, and these are, by the way, general rules, because actually there's other ways in which we could get more detailed and granular with it. But soluble fiber, the fiber that you put into a drink and you stir and it's gone, it disappears. It turns out that this is actually food for our microbiome. Fiber is unique because we don't have the enzymes to digest fiber. And because we don't have the enzymes, people generally have had the belief that, oh, well, it gives me a good bowel movement. It must just pass through. It must scrape the sides of the colon and absorb cholesterol. That description is really insoluble fiber. The soluble fiber is food for the microbes, but it's not digested. So it arrives into the colon intact. And when it gets there into the colon, the large intestine, the microbes get into a feeding frenzy because they have the enzymes that we lack. So in other words, us big, strong humans, we have 17 of these things called glycoside hydrolases. 17 is a pathetic number. There are single cellular bacteria that live inside of us right now that have hundreds of these enzymes. And when you take them as a whole, the microbiome, when we're seeing this big picture view of these 38 trillion microbes, they have tens of thousands of enzymes and they work in teams. And when they do this, what ends up happening, and this is extremely relevant to metabolic health, what I'm describing right now is extremely relevant to GLP-1 and the natural release of GLP-1 within our body. What ends up happening is that these microbes actually release nutrients that we only get access to because of our microbiome. Specifically, they release short-chain fatty acids, butyrate, acetate, and propionate. Now, many people perhaps have heard of butyrate. This is in my years of studying medicine. I started medical school in 2002. So in my over 20 years of studying medicine, these are by far the most anti-inflammatory chemicals that I've ever come across. And they're responsible for insulin sensitivity. They help us to control our blood pressure. And importantly, they help us to regulate our appetite, to feel full and satiated, and the release of GLP-1 from our body's natural stores. So the way in which our body actually naturally releases GLP-1 is we consume fiber. The fiber by itself doesn't do it. If we were sterile and didn't have a microbiome, we would not get the benefit of GLP-1 from that fiber. But because we have a microbiome, those microbes consume the soluble fiber, release short-chain fatty acids like butyrate, which activates the release of GLP-1, and then that spreads throughout the body and has the effects that we see with these drugs, which include us feeling full and also include us controlling our blood sugar much better. So, and the reason why this is such a relevant conversation and important is it's not just the anecdote of me, and it's not just the anecdotes of the thousands of patients I took care of. This is the fact that 95% of Americans are deficient in fiber right now. And yet, look at the metabolic disease that we're dealing with.
That's amazing. All right, we got to feed our microbiome, huh? And we need more soluble fiber for that. And I suppose that's all this wide variety of plants and vegetables that you're putting in your in those smoothies you were making. That's why it's not just all about eating a bunch of popcorn or flax seeds.
Exactly.
That's more insoluble, that stuff. I mean, I guess you sort of think it's the main action, but it's not. There's much more going on. You know, you're feeding bacteria. You're mentioning the GLP-1s. I'm sure there's other things that are getting produced. Let's talk more about that. I mean, what's the function of all these friendly bacteria that you got to feed?
They do many different things within our body. They affect our digestion. So this fiber is just one example of this. But like another example would be polyphenols. People talk about eat the rainbow and the different colors within our food. Many people know that, like, for example, blueberries have a specific family of chemicals called polyphenols that make them blue. And they're good for many different parts of our health, including like particular blueberries have these anthocyanins that are good for our brain health. What people don't realize is that we don't get access to those nutrients until they come into contact with our microbiome. Again, this is new scientific discovery, but what we've realized is that in order for us to access polyphenols and the benefits that we get from these, that many people are now hyping up, the result of our microbiome. That's how we do that.
I see. They won't be, other they're not processed or absorbed, they get some assistance in breaking them down.
Exactly. They have to be processed, and they're large molecules, and we don't have special enzymes to break down those molecules because they're not carbohydrates, fat, or protein. You know, we have enzymes for those things. We don't have enzymes for polyphenols. Again, our microbiome steps up and basically provides what we're not capable of doing. You know, Amal, this is the nature of our relationship with these microbes that goes back to the very first human, whoever that person was. They had a microbiome. We evolved with them. We outsourced aspects of our health to the microbiome. And this was important for human evolution, for us to co-evolve with these microbes. Because like as we radiated out across the planet, you know, the problem is that the diet that exists, like for example, where you are in Namibia, is very different than the diet that would be found in northern latitudes. And as we rapidly radiated out across the globe, our digestive system can't evolve quick enough to keep up with the changes that exist in our ecosystem. So what we needed something else that could change very quickly. That's where the microbiome comes in. The microbiome is capable of changing within 24 hours.
I want to pause for a minute here and talk to you about Life Extension Ventures. It's the reason I'm doing this series for In the Know. Life Extension Ventures is a venture fund dedicated to working towards the longevity of people and planet. The future of humanity depends on our planet surviving. And its potential can really only be unlocked if we focus on some of the technologies, some of the breakthrough science that's making it possible for us to live longer and better lives. Life Extension Ventures is a venture fund focused on supporting visionary founders that are working towards longevity of people and planet. It's the future of humanity that they're working on, and we want to back them. I spent a lot of time as a science person, as an academic, as a student, and then I spent even more time becoming a company builder and venture investor. And with Life Extension Ventures, I'm bringing both of those things together with my partner, Iñaki Berenguer. It's got a similar story. And we're out there finding folks who want to build companies that can really make a difference for human life. We'll need this planet if we want to survive, and we'll need to focus on these breakthrough technologies if we really want to unlock human potential. So here we are doing it, and sharing with you in this episode is some of the breakthrough science that we've been learning about and trying to back.
And how dramatically? Yeah, let's start exploring, I don't want to call them more peripheral, but maybe some of the more challenging areas. The microbiome varies. Some people want to modulate their microbiome, and maybe we can explore both of these topics. So one of them is the idea that changing your diet or doing some kind of cleanse can dramatically change your microbiome. And on that same theme, there are these other interventions like bariatric surgery that have some kind of big effect on the biome, apparently, as well. So in an individual, how much can you change? How much can you modulate? Is it real? Is it not real? Are there some things that work? And then I also want to talk about across populations and across geographies, you know, the Japanese microbiome versus the, you know, European gut biome. Let's tackle both of these themes, maybe starting with how much can I change my gut biome? Should I get some kind of assay and get some kind of map of my biome? And what could I actually do about it if I had that map?
Okay, well, so first of all, your microbiome is unique fingerprint. It's specific to you. If you had an identical twin, it's possible that you do, I don't know. But if you had an identical twin, you would share only about 30 or 35% of the same microbes, even though you would have the exact same genetic code, even though you grew up like presumptively in the same home with the same parents, eating the same meals, perhaps even similar recreational activities, you would still be more different than you would be the same. A reflection of your environment. Now, when we say environment, this is an environment that in many ways we have control over because we make a choice what we put into our mouth, chew and swallow. And that creates the environment for these microbes. So in a weird way, we are like a god to them. We have the ability to shape everything within this system. And it doesn't give us total control. There are some aspects to this. You can't just completely flip it out. You're not going to start over. There's a story. It's specific to you. It starts with birth. And whether or not you were born, for example, by cesarean or passed through your mother's vaginal birth canal. And those, there's a difference. This is your first exposure to the world. The world is not dominated by humans. The world is dominated by microbes. They're everywhere, literally everywhere. The only way that they're not there is if we made them not there as humans by like sterilizing things. And it's a story that as you go, for example, it could be you, it could be the listener at home. You go through your childhood and, you know, perhaps you are or are not exposed to antibiotics. You are either breastfed or you're bottle fed. These are differences. They shape the microbiome in different ways. The food that you eat as you grow up as a child, how much time you spend outside, whether or not you grew up in an urban environment or a suburban environment or a rural environment or in a different country compared to the United States. Like, did you ride your bike? How physically active were you? Did you have pets in your home? Did you have siblings?
You've convinced me that the environmental factors are enormous. And in a sense, I mean, the microbes themselves are part of the environmental situation, right? I mean, it's not just your DNA. It's you get started, some things come from all around, and what you eat and what you breathe and who you're around and all that. Okay, so the environmental factors are huge. But what about interventions? How much can we change it, right? I mean, the idea of a cleanse used in the popular language, I think is trying to promise some kind of whole new you, but you can't change it so much just by fasting for a week or drinking juices for a week, can you? How much can you really change affirmatively your gut biome in directions you want or by dietary modifications?
We have to sort of separate this question into sort of two aspects. Can you change your microbiome acutely? Can you change it right now? Absolutely. But that change doesn't have as much of an impact or meaning as your chronic, long-term, day-to-day microbiome. I mean, can we change right now? Of course, antibiotics right now, we could give you antibiotics and crush your microbiome, wipe out 65% of your microbes. And when we withdraw those antibiotics after whatever number of days, they will start to grow back. But also we would be leaving behind a scar. It won't be exactly the same. We would be able to tell that your microbiome is different relative to what it was prior to the antibiotics. Can you do a cleanse? You can do a cleanse. Does it actually improve your microbiome? Highly questionable. Depends on what you're doing. There are many things that are hyped up as being beneficial to us when I would argue they are in fact not, and they're actually destroying yourself in the process. The answer is yes, you can do things that will change your microbiome quite quickly. If you made a radical dietary modification, it would do the same. But the real question is, how do you achieve a healthy microbiome that powers your physiology and health throughout your body and helps you live better days every single day? And the answer is through long-term choices and consistency. So I'll give you a quick example, Amal. At Zoe, we have research. So we have done many different studies. I don't even know the number right now. We may be over 100 publications. It's a lot. And we have, I think, the most fascinating database for science of the microbiome out there, period. We have almost 200,000 people where we have their microbiome information. We have continuous glucose monitor data. We have blood test results. We have what they've been eating and their health history. Okay. So we can use all this and machine learning algorithms to understand it. And when we've done this, we ask the question, what is the food that is most clearly represented in the microbiome? The answer was surprising.
I'm dying to know.
It was coffee.
What?
Now, does this mean that coffee is healthier than eating a salad? Absolutely not. What's happening here, Amal, is that coffee, first of all, does contain bioactive chemicals like fiber. There's soluble fiber in coffee. There's also polyphenols in coffee. These are things that impact and shape the microbiome. But the key here is not that coffee is superior to alternative choices on a one-time basis. The key here is that people who drink coffee, they do it every day. And because they do it every single day, you build momentum in your microbiome. It's a snowball effect. The change initially may be small, but by doing this on a consistent basis, you are building momentum towards a healthier microbiome. This is the reason why, this is not a commercial for coffee. This is the reason why long-term dietary choices, not cleanses, not short, quick things, long-term consistent choices is the key to better health.
Fascinating. I mean, coffee has very strong results on general wellness, cognitive health, and just longevity results, right? I mean, it's like a 30% reduction in all-cause mortality among coffee drinkers versus not. But the reason why, I guess, people usually put their finger on the feeding the microbiome dimension, I suppose people have mentioned polyphenols and maybe the stimulant effect of caffeine on cognition, but this is a whole new direction.
So here's my take on that. So first of all, coffee actually turns out in the American diet that's devoid of quality food, where 95% of us are deficient in fiber, but that's not just fiber, Amal. When we say that we're deficient in fiber, it basically means we're not eating plants. So we're deficient in all of the plant-based nutrients. Polyphenols are plant-based nutrients. Within that context, coffee is actually the number one source of polyphenols in the American diet.
Unbelievable. So, I mean, it's like a vegetable infusion, right? I mean, it depends on how you look at it, but I mean, coffee is not meat. It's a plant seed. And we're drinking an infusion from it, I guess.
100%. And again, it has an appreciable amount of soluble fiber, enough where given the pathetic intake of fiber in the United States, like you can literally boost your fiber intake by 10, 15% just by having a couple cups of coffee.
And then, I mean, and your bigger point, of course, is that it's about long-term behavior and diet change. And so you've noticed it in the data from Zoe. And I want to get into Zoe a little bit. Let's talk about Zoe. And what else matters then if coffee is showing up so high in the registry? What else is standing out in your data?
The argument that I would make, and you know, I guess let me bring it back to the science and like the published science, because that's, I think, what we're most proud of. That's what I'm most proud of as the US medical director of this company, is that we have developed an approach to personalized nutrition. And I can explain like what the Zoe kit is and how it works in a moment, but I just want to get this out real quick, which is to say that, you know, look, we could just market. I mean, you know, you've dealt with a lot of companies. Marketing is really important. That's what matters if you want customers. But what we chose to do in addition to marketing our product is we invested a substantial amount of time, effort, and money into running a clinical trial. And this was completely public, where there's no backing out of this. We put it all on the line. The chips are on the table. And here's what ended up happening. We published it in May of this year in Nature Medicine, which is literally the top medical journal on the planet. Like, there's not a superior journal. Give me any on the planet, this is the one I would pick. And we're very proud of it because in our randomized controlled trial, we compared the Zoe program to following US dietary guidelines. And basically what we found is that when people are doing the program, they get tremendous health benefits that include lowering their triglycerides, lowering their hemoglobin A1C, which for people at home, that basically what I'm saying is you're getting better blood sugar control, whether you have diabetes or you don't have diabetes, better blood sugar control. They lost weight. They had better mood. They slept better. They had more energy. They actually were less hungry. But the key is not just that. What the key is that the people who actually really, truly followed the advice, people really did it. Because of course, in any study, there's some people who are like, oh, whatever, I'm over that. For people who actually did it, they lost about 5% body mass. They shrunk their waist circumference by 2.5 inches. That is really important from a visceral fat perspective, which is the unhealthy fat. They lowered their total cholesterol, their LDL cholesterol substantially. They lowered their blood pressure. You get all of these benefits. And this is from the key, Amal, is dietary pattern. So it's not the one magic food. It's that you're building a dietary pattern so that basically you're rising the tide on your overall diet. It's not just that one substitution, it's all of the substitutions and how they all balance out for you.
That's an amazing result. Maybe you can also compare it to, you know, some of the other diets that are recommended to folks that are sort of at risk, pre-diabetic or with heart health, vegan diet or a keto diet, or, I mean, because US like recommended, whatever the USDA kind of standard is, maybe it's a lower bar, right?
It depends on how you look at that. I mean, when I, as a medical doctor, when I look at the US dietary guidelines, most people don't follow them. Very few people actually follow the guidelines. But if you actually follow them, I wouldn't sit here and say that they're atrociously bad. If we were given a report card, it would be probably a B+. Could we do better? Sure. But you know what? Some of the dietary patterns that you just mentioned, let's just keep it real. Like, for example, a vegan diet, there are good vegan diets. Those are plant-based diets. There are also really bad ones. Those are junk food diets. Keto, Like you could eat bacon all day, or you could be eating nuts and seeds and avocados and extra virgin olive oil. With any of these things, when we speak sort of high level, really the question comes back to this big question of all, which is dietary quality. Zoe helps people to understand how to improve their dietary quality in a personalized way, by the way. Look, if you ate the way that I used to eat and you follow almost any substitutive diet, like you'll get better, right? But could you do even better than that? I think the answer is yes.
So how does Zoe work? You know, you're part of this company. You're a very like impact and research driven person, but these guys are building a business and I've heard about it. I mean, it's becoming a big company, I guess. Tell us about the product. So what do people sign up for? What do they get? They get some kind of test kit in the mail and you got to get the app and...
Yes. So it's a kit that comes in the mail. It starts with this concept, which is community driven science. This is, I think, the way of the future. The issue is that if we wait until our government funds big studies, we'll be waiting forever. They're cutting funding to the NIH. And even when they do fund these studies, they don't have the ability or capacity. Like they did a huge grant, massive grant, Amal, recently for personalized nutrition. And that was to fund a study of 10,000 people. We have over 100,000 people using Zoe literally right now. And we have much better information. Our government can't get it done. What we do is this. When a person signs up, Amal, if you sign up, basically what we're offering you is we send you a kit. And we're going to collect information about your microbiome. So there's a microbiome test. We're going to have you wear a continuous glucose monitor, which measures your blood sugar basically moment by moment. You can check in on that at any time. It's actually part of the process that's fun, is to see the unique effect of food on your own body in real time. We have you do a blood test, and then we also have you basically enter into an app your health history, how you've been eating generally, but also like what are you eating right now, so we can correlate that to your blood sugar. Now, the key here is that we take all of your information, and what you care about is results for you. But we are able to take that information, which is a tremendous amount, and bring it into this database that has close to 200,000 people. We started obviously much smaller than this, but as we continue to grow, your contribution makes us better, makes us stronger, makes our science even better. And now we can take this, run machine learning algorithms using AI to basically ask the question, if we were to recreate you personally, your biology in this database, what would we feed that person? So using those techniques, we're able to answer that question so that what we bring back to you is an approach that has actually been tailored to your unique biology. So, and that's what makes it a little bit different than like other approaches. Now, in order to do that properly, you need big data. You can't do this with a thousand people. You need tens of thousands of people, or in our case, over 100,000 people. And the big data is what allows us to ultimately get the detail that we need in order to really help people have a personalized approach to their health. So that's what Zoe is.
Fascinating. So with all this data of all these people and also this data about me, what level of granularity are you advising me or coaching me on how I want to adjust my, I guess, my diet mainly, or is it other things too?
Well, we're ultimately like we're motivated by our community. They trust us by making a purchase and joining the community. So ultimately, we need to deliver results. Results are measured in terms of health, like they were in that randomized controlled trial, health outcomes. In order for us to get you there, diet is the powerful way in which we can manipulate your physiology, your gut microbiome. But there's other aspects to this too, how you sleep, exercise, things like this. So a big part of Zoe is not just, hey, here's your results. Zoe is also a program that educates and empowers you. The things that you discuss on your podcasts with experts, the things that you and I are discussing literally today, this is information that's universally applicable. The concept of the microbiome and short-chain fatty acids, that matters to all of us. There's not a person that doesn't matter to. Let's take all that information, put it into a program, but then at the same time, when we give you your diet plan, we give you scores for individual foods. If you had a spouse, a partner, a friend, a twin, and you compared your scores to that other person, you would see they're quite different. And you use those scores to make choices. And the idea isn't that there's this one food. And the idea also isn't that there's any food that's off limits. The idea is instead that you want to try to just elevate the scores. So like ice cream or like a Snickers bar, is that the end of the world? Absolutely not. But what we want to do is try to generally make choices that raise our scores. And those scores are defined by these unique factors from you, what we've learned about you through our process.
Fascinating. And I guess the broad outlines you've been laying out, but the ability to measure continuously from a well-analyzed starting point, I guess, is what's unique. I mean, sort of blindly adding a few smoothies to my routine wouldn't be as helpful if I didn't know how I was progressing. And that'd be the idea.
That's a great point. That brings us into some of the things that are more Zoe version 2 in a way, because we launched back in 2020 and we're building. We're building and we're continuing to try to strive to do better on multiple different fronts. And one of them is to create a longitudinal experience so that it's not just, hey, you do Zoe, you get a kit, we tell you what to do, and then that's the end of the story. We want people to basically make Zoe a way of life. Part of what happens is that you check back in with a microbiome test. And I think that this is important to do a second microbiome test because we want to see where you're at, how things have evolved with what you've been doing, and be able to redefine what direction we go from here. So if you were to continue to do this, then what we do is we start to get longitudinal data points. And that's the same way that it works when you go to your doctor. It's longitudinal data. I'll just tell you as a medical doctor, like a big part of working with people is not what they say on the first visit. A big part of working with people is seeing how they respond to different things over time.
Yeah, that's huge. So interesting. So, you know, just like the sweep of our conversation here has been a impassioned speech to feed the friendly microbes.
Yeah.
The wide variety. Wide
Sorry, variety I can't of- help myself.
No, and you fit. I mean, it's an important way to think about what's going on with diet. I mean, it's not just calories, I guess, and not just cholesterol or whatever people think. It's about the wide variety of different soluble and insoluble fibers and all the other nutrients that come from this wide variety of plant-based foods, mainly, it sounds like, and the multiple benefits that come from a happy and healthy microbiome.
I completely agree. If there's one thing I want our listeners to take away from today that I hope that they will do, and that I think is quite actionable, is just add more variety of plants to your diet. You know, when you're in the supermarket grabbing something that you haven't tried before, it could be in the kitchen when you're, for example, making a pot of chili and you're like, what can I throw into this chili? Pot of tomato sauce. What can I throw in this tomato sauce? Or it could be when you're sitting down at the table and you're saying, okay, what am I going to put on my plate? And the answer is you want more variety of plants. Let me just say, I'm not here to make an argument about an exclusively plant-based diet or not. That's a personal choice. And there's also other factors like ethical questions that are a part of that story. I'm here to say that because 95% of Americans are deficient in fiber and because our health is failing and we are progressively getting less metabolically healthy, this, for the vast majority of people who are listening to the show right now, is the great opportunity. And it doesn't have to be an all or nothing thing. But the opportunity is about leveling up your diet simply by adding more plant-based foods.
Amazing. Dr. B, thank you for being with us. I think it's been an incredibly informative hour. Well, I'm going to keep drinking coffee, but I'm definitely going to make some changes myself.
I love it, Amal. It's really cool. And if you end up checking out Zoe, I would love to hear back from you how that works out for you and what you think about it all. It's always fun for me to hear stories from people who have tried it, and particularly when they've had great results.